You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Father, man, so grateful to walk in here this morning into this place and this community. Thank you for the people that you've brought together here. Thank you for all the hard workers who volunteer to make this meeting happen. And we're here because we want to learn about you. We want to learn from your scriptures, and you've spoken to us in them. So we just invite you here this morning. I ask that you'd help me to really clearly exposit and show what you've written here, so that anyone can access it. And we ask your spirit here to move among us. Amen. All right, cool. So yeah, Romans. That's what we're studying, is the book of Romans. We started last week, and our plan is to exposit our way, starting from chapter 1 and go all the way through. And so that's a big undertaking. Last week, we made it all the way through the greeting. So we got verses 1 through 7 under our belt. And so that means this week, we're going to start in verse 8. So let's just jump right in. Romans 1:8 says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the world. For God, whom I serve in my spirit in the preaching of the gospel of his Son, is my witness as to how unceasingly I make mention of you, always in my prayers, requesting if perhaps now, at last, by the will of God, I will succeed in coming to you. And so this is Paul writing to the church in Rome. And in this section, he begins to start describing some of the occasion for the letter, what he's trying to accomplish in writing them. And I think it's interesting because even though he's moving on, you know, last week we talked, the whole time we talked about the gospel. And even though he's moving on, guess what? He's still talking about the gospel. Like, look here, in verse 9, he could have just said, for God is my witness as to how much I pray for you. But he doesn't say that. He says, for God, parentheses, whom I serve in my spirit in preaching the gospel of his Son, is my witness. He is laser focused on this one topic, really the whole time, because as I argued last week, that's what this book is really about. The gospel, which is the word that means the good news. The announcement that God has, the proclamation that God has. And that's what Paul is focused on. And that's what we talked about all last week. And so as we go through and read this next section, I'm still going to be pointing out things about the gospel that Paul is trying to communicate to us. The whole idea here, if you weren't here last week, the whole idea of the good news is that God has done something to remedy the essential question for humanity, the essential problem, which according to the biblical worldview, there is a God and we're created by him. And that means, and I think you could follow that logically, that if that were the case, that our relationship with God would be like the most important feature of our life in existence. If you're created by God, then where do you stand with him? And according to the Bible, there's a problem there, which is that we are wayward and rebellious, that our sin has created a barrier between us and God. And that's the whole crisis. That's the whole problem of the Bible. The gospel is the good news that God has done something on his end to reconcile this. That he has intervened through Jesus Christ to remove that problem, to erase that barrier, so that people, ordinary people, you and me, can be reconciled to God in this life and in the next life. That's the good news, that he's done that. And so really, it's an announcement, it's a proclamation, but it's also an invitation. God's done something, and you're invited to take part in that. You're invited to receive his forgiveness and be made right with him. That's what Paul is all about. That's the message that he's proclaiming. And this book really lays out systematically everything you need to know about that gospel. So that's what he's talking about. He says, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is being proclaimed through the whole world. Paul is excited because this good news message has made it to Rome. And Rome is, it's the heart of the empire, you know. And once you reach the heart, then that's going to send that message out all over the Roman world. And so he's super excited to hear this. And the thing about this, the thing about the gospel is that it spreads. You know, bad news spreads, but good news spreads too. When something really great happens, it gets around quickly. And the gospel is like that, in that here it's found its way all the way to Rome. I was thinking about examples of good news and like how we act when there's... Think about when you've gotten genuinely great news. My grandmother and grandfather were engaged during World War II. So he went off to fight in the Pacific Theater. And I remember sitting down and talking with my grandmother about, you know, sort of their time, how they met. And she said it was really hard because we were engaged to be married, but he was overseas. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And I thought about, man, that would be, think about actually the anxiety of that. She said, all I had was the radio. And so she said at work, we had a radio at work. She worked at Wright Pat. And she said we would sit and listen to the radio every day to get the news, to get the latest updates. And she said, I'll never forget one day this kid came busting into the cafeteria and said, turn it on, turn on the radio. And they turned it on and it was the news that the war had ended and that her man was coming home. And I said, oh man, you know, what did you do? Did you cry? Did you scream? And she said, I got on the cafeteria table and I danced. And I've heard that story a few times, but I got to be honest, it was always really hard to believe. You know, it's like my grandma, you know? And so I'm like, really? I don't know. I can't actually picture that in reality. But then for this teaching, I started Googling images of VJ Day. And, you know, it did get kind of crazy. Like, I was like, they partied. And I saw this picture. I don't know. Listen, I don't actually even know what is happening in this picture. I think he might be drinking a toast while doing a headstand. But when I saw this picture, I was like, okay, I believe it. The woman danced on a table. The gospel's like that. Stop what you're doing. Turn on the radio. Something big happened. And that's what's happened here is the gospel has gone out past even where people were intentionally proclaiming it. It's just finding its way. And now it's found its way to Rome. He says, I want you to know that I'm unceasingly praying for you. Which tells us another thing about the gospel, which is that it's exciting. How excited do you have to be to pray nonstop for strangers? Paul's never even met these guys. And he's like, I'm praying for you constantly. I can't remember to pray for my kids half the time. Right? He is so excited that the message has made it there. And he says, in my prayers, what I'm asking God is that at last, if it's his will, I want to come there to you. That's what Paul wants. He wants to go to Rome. For, he says, I long to see you. I mean, listen to that language. He wants to be there so bad. Where Paul is writing from is Corinth, which is right here in Greece. And that's pretty much the westernmost extent of his work. This movement started in Jerusalem, of course, and the missionary journey started from Antioch there. And over the many years, Paul has been bringing the gospel from Antioch out westward. What's amazing, why he's so excited is that what he's hearing is the gospel's now here in Rome, way further out. And that's why he's desperate to go there. And actually, at the end of the book, he says, I really want to come there on my way further west to Spain. That was his hope and his goal. He's super excited. He says, I want to come so that I may impart some spiritual gift to you, that you may be established. That is, that I may be encouraged together with you while among you, each of us by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I feel like if I come there, I could give a gift to you. I want to establish you, he says, which that's the word for like support or like to prop something up. He knows they've heard the message, but he wants to come and make sure they've got a solid base of theology. He wants to come and reinforce what's already happening there in Rome. And he's like, I have something for you, but also it will be an encouragement to me. Right? That our faith together, he's like, it's going to be great. It'll be good for you and it'll be great for me too. You know, like when someone gets engaged, you know, it's so exciting to, you start calling everybody up and telling them, You know, you call your parents, you call your grandparents, you call your best friends, you call everybody, and that's what you do that day, is you call people and you tell them. And it is mutually wonderful. They're excited, but you're getting something out of it too, the sharing and the good news together. And pretty soon, you know, if you do that long enough, after an hour or two, you start calling people up and you say, guess what? And they're like, I already heard. Because the good news starts outpacing your ability to spread it. That's what's happening. And he's like, you guys have it? I have to be there. I have to be there. And we will be encouraged, both you and me. This is common ground among strangers, right? That he knows when I get there, we will have common ground because we share this most important thing in common. And that's really true. It's one of the great things about following Christ is that anywhere you go in the world, you're going to run into other Christians who are different in every way, right? Different denominations, different backgrounds, different colors of skin, different personalities and socioeconomic backgrounds or whatever, and yet there is this camaraderie, there's this joy, there's something that builds you both up just by meeting each other because you share this most important thing in common. He says, I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I have often planned to come to you, and I've been prevented so far, so that I may obtain some fruit among you also, even as among the rest of the Gentiles. For I am under obligation both to Greeks and to the uncultured, both to the wise and to the foolish. You know, he's like, I'm so tied up with, I have all of these obligations. God's called me to bring the gospel to all different kinds of people. And yet, I so badly want to get there as soon as I can. Because they're playing his jam. That's what's happening here, all right? He says, so, for my part, I'm eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Then he says in verse 16, he says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Now, I think this is an interesting verse, and this is actually what I want to spend the rest of our time on, is this. He says this sort of curious thing. He says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Not ashamed. He brings up the idea of shame. And shame is a really interesting concept. Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. What does it mean? You know, we throw that word around a lot in different ways. What does it mean to feel ashamed of something? Shame's kind of an interesting idea because really, you know, one of the things that it describes is a feeling. You feel ashamed when you do something that you're not proud of. I walk in the room, I see that my little son has drawn on the wall with a crayon, and I'm like, whoa, what happened? This is a true story. When he was like 3 years old, and he looked up at me and he said, Dad, don't see. You know, it's like his request was that I wouldn't see what he had done. That's shame. Okay? And shame is importantly different from guilt. All right? Guilt is something, if I feel guilty, that's a feeling that I have really within myself. That's like, I'm my own audience in that. I've done something and I don't feel good about it before myself. That's guilt. Shame is more social. Shame is when I don't feel good about it in front of you all, in front of people who are watching. And therefore, you can feel shame whether you've legitimately done something wrong or not. You can feel shame when it incurs the disapproval of your peers. That's what shame is. You know, the internet's full of memes of dog shame. Dogs, you can always tell when they feel shame. You walk in, they've shredded the trash can, and they go into shame mode. All right? So, you know, just to get these words straight, while they're shredding the trash, they are guilty. They're objectively guilty. Whether they feel guilty or not, I don't know, because I'm not in their heart and mind, all right? The shame occurs when you walk in the room and see them, and they're like, oh, no. That's shame, okay? And shame is extraordinarily powerful. Here's the thing. Shame is extraordinarily powerful. If you think about it for a minute, how much does it impact what you do, the idea that other people might disapprove of it? I think it's probably one of the most powerful things in terms of, you know, something that can make you do something you don't want to do, or something that can stop you from doing something that you do want to do. shame is incredibly powerful. And shame exists in all cultures. In Paul's culture, you know, he lived in an honor-shame society where that was a bigger deal. But basically, shame ends up being a cultural enforcement mechanism. You know, whatever the culture is, that's going to be, if you cross that, if you go out of bounds of that, you're going to incur shame. And I think, just as a side note, I think that our culture right now is in love with shame. I think our culture is having a rediscovery of shame. I just was reading a news article recently that was talking about how the internet has really amplified shame on all sides. You know, it's the choice of weapon in the culture wars, that it just becomes this one side lobbing shame at the other, and that the internet companies really kind of love this because it generates clicks and buzz. And so there's a lot of shame going around. But you know, it's powerful. Think about, like, get something in your mind that you're kind of ashamed of, that you'd be happy if no one in this room knew about. It's like, say, your senior picture, okay? Let's say, what if I told you that the next slide on this PowerPoint was your senior picture, okay? What lengths would you go to stop me from pushing this button? You're like, oh, of course he doesn't. How do you know? I'm crazy. I might have your senior picture. What if I do? Feel the shame? You feel it? Psych, I don't have any of your senior picture. Just Ryan Lowry. He's not here, so we can shame him. At risk of getting too far off track, I do want to draw everyone's attention to his eyebrow. Shame is really strong, all right? Shame can affect behavior. But here's the weird thing about shame is that sometimes we will ignore it. Sometimes we'll move ahead and do something knowing that it's going to incur shame, and yet we do it anyway. Can you think of examples like that? That's called being shameless. All right? Being shameless is when I'm like, yep, I'm going to get shame, but I'm going to do it anyway. So for example, if I believe my culture thinks it's wrong, but I believe it's right, it's truly right, and I have a lot of integrity, I may be able to step forward and know I'm going to get shame, but I believe it's right. Or another example would be like an emergency. If there was a fire in the kitchen and you saw it, you would probably run into this room and say, fire! And you would feel that you're breaking a lot of social norms. You'd feel a little shame, but it would be worth it because there's a fire. So fear can do it. Emergency. If you lost your dog, you might walk through your neighborhood calling out, Biscuit, come home! And you would feel shame, but whatever. Shame, being shameless means looking shame in the eye and being like, it's worth it. Fear can do it. Emergencies can do it. Joy can do it. Like my grandma dancing on a table, right? Shameless, but who cares? He's coming home. But I think the biggest thing of all, the thing that most effectively lets us transcend shame is love. Love is the thing that we will do the most shameless things for. You know, when I was dating Sarah, I was head over heels. I used to work early in the morning, but what I would do sometimes is I would wake up early and I would write her a note for the day, like a love note, you know. And then I would go and I would put it under the windshield wiper of her car on my way to work. And one day, one of my roommates like caught me red-handed. He's like, what are you doing? Are you, you know, is that a love note? Oh, you're putting that on her car? Oh, man! And of course, he commenced with the shame, right? He's like, oh, she's got you wrapped around her finger, you know. And he's like, wait till I tell everyone else what you're doing. And I remember I looked at him for a second, and then I was like, yep, that's what I'm doing, you know? Worth it. Shame, ineffective. A couple days ago, I was walking through my office. We have a common workspace, and I saw my friend Keegan Hale, and he was there with his one-year-old. And they were having family time and stuff, and when I passed through again the next time, they were playing hide-and-seek. And so he was hiding behind a chair, like squeezed up against the wall. Grown man, crouched down, hiding. You know, we walked by and we kind of made eye contact. And I did what any good friend would do, which is I took the opportunity to amuse myself by shaming him. And so, you know, I was like, oh, hey, man, what you doing? He's like, yeah, you know, we're playing hide and seek. Oh, you're hiding? He's like, yeah. But here's the thing. He didn't stop, right? Shame ineffective. We're willing to make ourselves fools for truth, for love, for crisis. And that's how it goes. I should have shamed him more. I should have been like, you know, hey, you know what your daddy really likes to play is dance and sing a long time, you know. This wasn't sharp enough in the moment. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. I am not ashamed. But we've got to ask ourselves the question, why is he saying that? You know, you don't say I'm not ashamed of something unless there's a reason to think that, you know, someone might think you should be ashamed. You don't say I'm not ashamed of my diploma. No one says, if you come to my house, you say, nice trophy. I'm not going to say, I'm not ashamed of this trophy. No, you say like, I'm not ashamed, of my Star Wars collection. Okay? I'm not ashamed to wear one kind of plaid with another kind of plaid. I had a blizzard for dinner. I'm not ashamed. That's when you say that. So, but he's saying it about the gospel. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Is the gospel a cause for shame? That's the question that this begs here. And actually, when you put yourself in Paul's shoes, this makes perfect sense. Because one thing you have to realize from his point of view is Paul had reasons to feel ashamed. He had legitimate reasons to feel shame standing up there and proclaiming Christ. A bunch of them. You know, first of all, the gospel scandalized Jews. And Paul was a Jew. He was a prominent Jew. He was an important leader of Jews. He was a Pharisee. And yet, here's this message that completely scandalized his people. 1 Corinthians 1:23 says, we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. You know, Jews expected a Messiah to come. But they expected the conquering King Messiah. So here is Paul saying the Messiah is come, and he was, you know, he didn't take power. He didn't take over Rome or something. He came and was humble. He came and he was a nobody. The Messiah has come, and it's this guy who wanders around and doesn't even have a place to stay. The Messiah has come and he washes feet. He says, we preach Christ crucified. Those two words don't go together. Christ means Messiah. We teach Messiah crucified. Messiah killed in the most shameful way imaginable, right? Humiliated, mocked, teased, hung up naked and tortured in public. He says, you know, this is what we preach. And so for the average Jewish listener, it'd be like, that, no, I just can't. You're saying the Messiah's come and he was crucified? No, no, no. Paul drew scorn from his old community. Like I said, he was a Pharisee. He was a leader. He was viewed as a traitor because he turned from that to follow Jesus Christ. That would have cost him his reputation. Acts 22:3, Paul says, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly, according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God. Paul was like the rising star. You know, Gamaliel was the most important guy, the most important Jewish leader of the time. He's the grandson of Rabbi Hillel. These guys are still venerated and read and studied today. And Paul was his disciple. Like Paul is, he is the rising star, and then he turns. What do you think Gamaliel thought about Paul? What do you think it felt like to be Paul and know that these men that you had won their approval now would disapprove of you? I'm sure that Gamaliel was ashamed of Paul. You know, you could have been something. And now you're off, you know, wasting your life. Imagine having, you know, a hero who mentors you who then is now ashamed of you. Paul also was an outsider in his new community, because we know from Acts 9 that people had a lot of trepidation about Paul because he used to persecute the church. So he leaves one community and enters another community, and both of them don't have a very high view of him. The other problem, he says, Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. It didn't sound any better to the Gentiles. You know, the Romans, they're like, whoa, you have, hold up, you have one God. First of all, one God. We have many gods. You know, you have one God, and he got crucified. You know, he was a carpenter. This is your God? And the other problem was that Christianity subverted a lot of Roman norms. You know, so what? You're going to hang out with slaves? You know, you're going to put men and women on the same footing? Caesar should bow down to your crucified God? Forget it. You know, he rose from the dead? That's disgusting. The gospel sounded just as outrageous to them as it does today in our culture. And let's not forget that at its very heart, the gospel is offensive. There's really no way around this. I would like to sugarcoat it and be like, it's beautiful. And it is beautiful. The gospel is beautiful. It's also shockingly offensive. There is a God. You're not him. He has a moral standard. You fall short. We all deserve judgment. That's the bad news. That's what the first three books of the chapters of this book are all about. But even when you then turn the page to the solution, that's kind of offensive too. You can't fix it. You can't earn your way out of it. You have to receive it as a gift. You have to be rescued. That's your only hope, is to be rescued humbly, and you have to submit to him. You have to receive it as a free gift by his grace. All of that offends the pride. So yeah, Paul had reasons. 2 Corinthians 6:4. Listen, he describes his life in afflictions, in hardships, in difficulties, in beatings, in imprisonments, in mob attacks, in labors, in sleeplessness, in hunger, by glory and dishonor, by evil report and good report, regarded as deceivers and yet true. This Paul turned his reputation inside out and became a reproach. So yeah, he's got reason to say, and I'm not ashamed. You all think I should be ashamed. I am not ashamed of the gospel. And I'd just like to point out that I don't think these factors are all that different from Paul's time to now. You know, a lot of these same features that generate shame, we incur similar things in our culture. And if you've spent time following Christ, then I bet you know what I'm talking about. Have you ever noticed that when you're in a conversation with someone you don't know that well, have you ever noticed how hard it is to use the word Jesus in that conversation? I mean, I'm ashamed to say this up here, but it's true. Like, I'll talk about, you know, yes, I have a strong faith. I go to church. It's really hard to say Jesus. Why is that? What am I embarrassed about? Someone says, oh, what do you got going on tonight? And the answer is Bible study. Why is it that I'm a little bit tempted to just nerf that and say, oh, I'm hanging out with some friends? You know, why is that? I think that it's shame. And I started thinking through, okay, well, what are the factors that might make you feel that way? What are the fears? And, you know, there's a few of them, right? Maybe I'm thinking, I don't want them to think bad about me. You know, I don't want them to jump to conclusions about me. I don't want them to think that I'm a weirdo or that guy. I don't want them to lump me in with whatever stereotype they have of Christians and think that I'm weird. I don't want them to think that I'm dumb or naive or something like that. And I also don't want to have to explain what I believe, because I don't want to start a fight. And if I tell them what I believe, it might seem silly or stupid to them, or it might offend them. I might be put in a position where I have to defend my faith, and I don't feel I can't do that today. Or the big shame fear that they're gonna call me out. They're gonna embarrass me in front of others. Those are just the ones in my head. Maybe you have different ones, but my point is that I think we can all relate with this idea that when you stand out there for the gospel, you are probably going to get shame directed your way. So Paul had reasons to feel ashamed, and so do we. But here's what's amazing. What's Paul say? For I am not ashamed. This is his whole point. He's like, I am not ashamed. And actually, as you study his life and as you read this book, Paul was the opposite of ashamed. Whatever ashamed is, he's the polar opposite of that. All right, he says, for my part, I'm eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. I'm chomping at the bit. I can't wait to get there. I'm dying to come and preach. Preach. Proclaim. You know what that word is? That's the word euangelizo. It's like gospel. It's to proclaim the gospel. He's talking about being a herald. He's like, I can't wait to get to Rome so that I can herald this good news. I want to shout it from the rooftops. I want to ride in on my horse and be like, good news, everybody. You've got to hear this. It's the opposite of ashamed. So here's our big question then. Where is Paul's shame? He's got every reason to feel ashamed, and yet here he is right out of the gate being like, first thing you got to know about me is that I'm about the gospel, and second thing you have to know about me is I am not ashamed. Why not? Where is Paul's shame? Well, I know a few things about Paul that I think help explain why Paul had no shame. Let me just go through a couple of them. First of all, Paul had seen Jesus' shameless love. This idea of loving someone without shame, you know, the originator of it is Jesus Christ. One of the really shocking things about the Bible, you know, I told you there's this big problem between man and God, and the story of the Bible is God's intervention to fix that, to reconcile it. What's amazing is that God actually does something incredibly shameful in order to do this. Philippians 2:6, this is just talking about Jesus. It says, though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. Jesus, the Son, in heaven, perfect, glorified, creator. He said, I'm going to rescue humanity, and to do that, I'm going to put on flesh. I'm going to be born a baby. I'm going to have my diaper changed. You know, it's a very shameful thing. He came down here into the lost, wayward, rebellious world filled with sin and disease and every other problem. He waded right into that. You know how shameful that is for a king? There's a scene in one of my favorite miniseries, John Adams, that HBO did a few years ago, a lot of years ago, actually. But there's the, you know, John Adams was president of the United States. He had a son who, he had several kids, but one of his children, he became very ashamed of. His son he was an alcoholic. He had ruined his life. He had wasted his money. And John Adams had really high hopes for him. But instead, he had ended up sort of living in these slums. And it became an embarrassment on the family. And so there's this scene in the show where it comes to a head, and John Adams is like, I'm going down there. And so here comes President Adams in all his finery, getting out of his stagecoach into the most abysmal slum you've ever seen, abandoned buildings, walking through searching for his son. And he finds him slumped over, unconscious, drunk at a table. And so there's this great drama. What's he going to do? What is President Adams going to do? The juxtaposition of this super successful man in this terrible place. And he looks at his son, and he viciously rejects him. He disowns him. You have embarrassed me. You are not my son. And the son is bawling and begging for forgiveness, and he says no, and he marches out and leaves. And historically, John Adams never spoke to his son again after that. Why? Because his son had embarrassed him. His son had brought shame upon the family. God had every right to do that. He would have been well within his rights to come down here just to tell us face to face that he's done with us. So think of the drama. He puts on flesh. He comes down. The Bible describes the angels watching like, what is he doing? He's going down there. What is going to happen? And then it says, when he appeared in human form, what did he do? He judged. No, He humbled himself. He humbled himself further in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on the cross. He let his own creation reject him, put him on trial, humiliate him, and kill him. Just think, you know, how did this look from the heavenly perspective? He's putting on a body. What is he doing? He's letting them kill him. Why? Why would he do this? This is so much shame. It's unbelievable, actually. Hebrews 12:2. Jesus, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Why did he do that? For the joy set before him. And what was the joy set before him? You and I. He came, it's love. It was his shameless love for mankind that said, all right, the only way that I can make this right is for me to go and number myself among the sinners, die a sinner's death in their place. And it's worth it. I'm willing to be ashamed. He says, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. Despise doesn't mean that he hated the shame. It means that he like repudiated it. He rejected it. He set aside. Yes, he did something incredibly shameful, but he didn't count that as anything. Why? For the joy set before him. So that he could save you and I, so that he could be reconciled with us for all eternity. And then he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Love overrides shame. Number two, Jesus was not ashamed of Paul. You know, Paul was a terrible sinner. He hunted and murdered Christians. Jesus confronted him. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And then what did he do? He showed him mercy and grace. He picked him up. He forgave him. And he said, actually, I have a job for you to do. I want you to go and tell this message to the whole world. That's why Paul opens the letter by saying, Paul, a bondservant of Jesus. I belong to Jesus Christ because I deserve judgment, and instead he accepted me. Called as an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God. Paul was grateful to God, who could have rejected him, but was not. God was not ashamed of him. On the cross, Jesus washed away the stain of our sin. We all have sin. We all have things that would cause us to stand in shame before God. But God says, let me wash you clean. Let me take that shame off your hands and put it on my son so that it can be put to death for all time. And you start over anew with me. And so the Christian life is one of freedom from shame. God doesn't use shame to change us. We don't use shame on each other. Our shame, our reproach died with Jesus Christ. And now I'm not saying we don't do things wrong. We do things wrong. But when we do something wrong, we can come before God and say, I messed up. I repent. Thank you for forgiving me. And we go forward without shame. Do you know how freeing it is to know that my permanent standing before God is righteous? Not because of me, because of his son, Jesus Christ. So he saw Jesus' shameless love for him. He saw that God was not ashamed of him, that he was washed clean. And look what he tells us. Here's his reason. Right here in verse 16, for I am not ashamed of the gospel. Why? Because it is the power of God for salvation. Look, how can I be ashamed of the thing that saves? It's effective. Paul understood that God's solution through Jesus Christ is the only way. There is only one way to make things right between God and man. And he did it. And therefore, that's the solution. And therefore, it does save. It is the power of God. That's the word dunamis, like dynamite, where we get the word dynamite. It's God's strength and power, and it's good enough, and it delivers. What Jesus Christ did on the cross, the proclamation about it, and the invitation to come and join in it is sufficient to save, and it's the only thing. And he's like, how could I be ashamed of that? It works. It sets us right with God. The gospel of Jesus Christ far outperforms every other gospel mankind can offer. This is an important point too, because our culture is filled with gospels. You know, it's filled with offers of remedies and solutions and salvations. And we look to all kinds of things. Every kind of fad and idea, every book, every philosophy, follow this person, follow this organization, fight this political fight. You know, chase this dream. You just need this experience. You just need this much money. Like we're constantly, you just need to be fit. You know, we constantly push things and it's like, if you have this, then you'll be happy. And here's the thing. Most of those things are good things. Those aren't bad things. But they do not save. They do not fix the problem between you and God. And so he's saying, do not be ashamed of the gospel, because the gospel is the thing that God has provided to actually save. And it's going to stand while every other fad comes and goes. Oh, on my way home from CT last week, I was listening to the radio and they were talking about this. The new buzzword is vibe shift. Have you heard this? It's the first time I heard it, so I'm not up on it, I guess. But they're talking about a vibe shift is something that happens in culture where the mood changes in culture. And everyone right now is saying our culture is going through a vibe shift. And that it's negative. We're getting in a bad mood as a culture, they're saying. And the reason in their analysis, they're like, this happens when there's a lot of hot ideas and then they fizzle. When the hot ideas that people have, when they become disillusioned with it, then they get in a funk that's like, nothing's ever going to get better. And that's how they were describing our culture. And I'm like, yes, exactly. That describes all, that's a short history of human nature. Getting excited about gospels that fizzle. Yeah, no surprise. Fad saviors will come and go. The gospel has stood for millennia. It has rescued people. It has reconciled them with their maker. It has changed their lives and destined them for eternity with God. And it will do that through the vibe shift. And it will do that through the next vibe shift and the one after that. Why? Because it is the power of God for salvation. To everyone. It is universal to every single person. Paul's looking around and he's like, yeah, the Jews, they need the gospel. The Gentiles, they need the gospel. Everybody. And we see this in Paul's life, that he was laser focused on the need of people around him. He understood in genuine love what these people really need is their God. That's what they need. And how do we get that? He says, from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous one will live by faith. It just means that this plan of God is accomplished completely through faith. It's not accomplished through works. It's that we come to him and we say, I want your death on the cross to pay for my sin. I trust you to rescue me because I cannot rescue myself. He says that is how you access the good news. And he says, for in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. This is God's plan for solving things, and it shows his majesty and righteousness. You know, hey, it might look shameful to our world. Our world might be like, that's the dumbest, most antiquated idea. God's not ashamed of it. He's like, actually, this really demonstrates my righteousness quite well. Yeah. Paul knew that the gospel shows God's glory. Look at 1 Corinthians 1:21. He says, for since the world, through its wisdom, did not come to know God. So there's what I just said, right? The world, in all our wisdom, so far, so bad on coming to know God. For the world, in all its wisdom, did not know God. God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. Okay, maybe my message is foolish, but it saves. I'm well pleased with it, he says. We preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block and to Gentiles foolishness. We read that verse. But to those who are the called, both the Jews and the Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. He's saying, laugh at it all you want. It's the wisdom of God. And God's dumbest ideas are miles above our best ideas. God doesn't have dumb ideas. I'm not trying to blaspheme. Just making a point. Guys, do not ever be ashamed of the gospel. Do not ever be ashamed of your faith. This world will give you every reason to cower and clam up and feel bad. Do not ever do that. 1 Peter 4 tells us, don't suffer as an evildoer or a troublesome meddler. You know, if you do something wrong, then repent and enjoy God's grace and freedom. But he says, but those who suffer as a Christian should not be ashamed. Never be ashamed for the grief you take when you stand for Jesus Christ. When the apostles were flogged and beaten in public in Acts, what does it say? It says they went home rejoicing, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name. They're like, man, Jesus did something shameful. We've joined in that because it is a supreme act of love. And I don't care how dumb I look. What if I told you that all those shame fears I listed would come true? What if I told you when your friend says, what do you got going on tonight? And you say, I'm going to Bible study because I believe in Jesus. And their friend's like, oh my gosh, I think so much less of you now. I didn't know you were that stupid. Tell me all about your message. You know, are you like those other weirdo Christians that I know? Oh, I can't believe your message is so offensive and silly. Hey, everyone, look how stupid Ben is. Let's say that all happens. That all happens. But it's also true. And someone meets Christ and is made right with him for eternity. Yeah, worth it. Shame ineffective. So how do we become a shameless herald? Well, we could probably talk about this all day. I just brainstormed a couple ideas for growing in our shamelessness like Paul. One thing is to reflect on God's shameless love for you. It's really hard to look at the cross and then turn around and be ashamed of Jesus. Another thing is to ask God to sensitize you to others' need for the gospel in genuine love. So the thing that makes us shameless is actual love, is genuine love and concern for other people. And you can't fake that. That's, you know, if you want to be shameless, you'll never really make a sacrifice for people that you don't care about. And so it begins with genuine love for other people. I think my biggest idea here was just to be real. You know, being bold, being shameless doesn't mean climbing up on the rooftops and proclaiming something. It means just not being ashamed. It means not hiding who you are. You know what? The problem with shame is shame makes you fake, right? Shame makes you put on an act so you look better in front of people. If you want to really be shameless, just be who you are and don't hide it. I'm going to Bible study on Tuesday night. You know, man, you seem really happy today, Ben. Well, you know, I learned something in the Bible that made me excited. Ben, I see that you're really going through a trial. You're right, I am. But you know what really gets me through is I depend on my faith. And I know that sounds out there. I know Jesus seems like a silly idea to a lot of people, but I have found that it's really changed my life following him. Be yourself. That's the definition of being shameless. It's not an act. Just be real. Pray for boldness. Take risks. When we don't take any risks because we're afraid of shame, you know what happens? The fear of shame grows because we never get any experience with it, and it becomes a monolith. If we take small risks, if we incur a little shame here and there, then we realize that its bark is a lot worse than its bite. Let your demeanor be characterized by humble confidence. It's not hubris. It's not pushy. I'm not anything special, but I believe this is true. That's humble confidence. Don't be surprised or discouraged when you share in the sufferings of Christ, including his shame. After all, you know, you say, I'm following Jesus. Okay, well, Jesus went to the cross. So keep that in mind every time you say, I follow Jesus. And don't be surprised when it means that shame comes your way. And of course, look ahead to future glory, because in the end, everything is going to come out in the wash. Everything true is going to be proclaimed by God. I've heard it said before that Christianity isn't a religion of honor in this life. It's a religion of delayed honor, right? We incur shame now, but we look forward to honor in the future. And finally, discover the freedom and joy of being a fool for Christ's gospel. It is a great way to live. So that's what I had on Romans and not being ashamed of the gospel. What we like to do at the end of our meeting is we like to open it up for questions and comments. And so if you raise your hand, we have some folks with microphones who will come around. And then we also have an opportunity to pray at the end also. So I see two hands. I see one right here, and I see one right here.
Ben, is this on?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there we are.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. I think this was your best teaching. It was so clear, so real,
Stop honoring me.
Oh my God. I was thinking, I was like, oh, I'm going to send him an email, but then I was like, I have to tell him. Anyways, but your examples about the shameless, like your grandma dancing on, I remember dancing on the bar in Israel when I was there. We were excited. And, you know, we were in this, and
were there
it was
pictures
worth it.
Taken of this event?
No, there isn't. well, I don't know. I was trying to think about it. Anyways, but to really look at the gospel as worth it, and that we want to share that with people, and not be ashamed. I loved all your examples. I just thought this was an amazing teaching, and I'm hoping it's really gonna radically change my life.
You know, I think a lot of us would say, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. That was kind of my attitude going into this, like, oh yes, I love this passage. But after just a few minutes of reflection, I was kind of amazed and disturbed to realize, wow, shame's actually having a lot more of an effect on me than I realized. And so I think it's a really good reminder from Paul. All right, let's go right next door, and then we'll still come over here.
Hopefully you can hear me. That was an awesome teaching, Ben. And I was thinking of that, just your last slide about being foolish for the gospel. And I kept trying to think of that verse, and my wife just found it. So I thought I would read it, where Paul says in 1 Cor 4:10, our dedication to Christ makes us look like fools, but you claim to be so wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are so powerful. You are honored, but we are ridiculed. And he goes on to say some of the ways he was ridiculed. But yeah, that idea of being a fool for Christ, you know, we all feel foolish at times sharing the gospel, but, you know, just you brought it out so clearly that it's worth it. And so, great job. Thanks for that motivation.
Cool. Thanks. All right. Here and then back there.
Yeah, am I on? There we go. I really agree with that last comment. I just wanted to say, I've been reflecting on this, and I've just been amazed thinking through, like, the people that I respect the most and look up to the most and who I want to become. They're all, like, the one thing that they all have is they are totally shameless. I'm sure they have the shame, but they wrestle through it, and they have really decided, here's what I believe. And I don't just mean spiritual people. I mean just people in general that are like, this is who I am. This is what I'm about. In a sense, I don't really care what you think about me. I'm going to be in my lane doing my thing. And I was just thinking, we could be a huge blessing to other people by really wrestling through this. Obviously, we want to be a witness for Christ, but there are other people watching us whom we are offending, yes. But there are a lot of people in the crowd, too, that are like, wow, there's something really different about him. And I, whatever he has, I want, you know? So,
you're right. There's something, you know, when someone's being shameless, you're like, there's a reason, you know? And if that reason seems like a principled reason, then it's pretty winsome. Yeah. All right, let's do last one right back here. And then if I didn't get you, I'll be up here afterward, and I'm happy to take any questions up here, too.
So my daughter loves to go, you know, if I have to run to the store, she wants to go with me. And she's 5, so as soon as we get out of the car, it's like, Daddy, let's skip to the door. And it's not just like subtly, it's how high can we skip this time? And, you know, if we're just going to the pet store to pick up food or the grocery store, like that, okay, you know. But, man, when we get to the hardware store, and especially because I tend to you know, park on like the lumberyard side. We're going in with all like the grizzled contractors, and they're just kind of staring me down as I'm skipping my way into the store. But it's worth it.
It's worth it.
And it's worth it for her and for my relationship with her and what that means to her.
Yeah.
And so as much as I feel the shame, it's worth it. And I feel that way when it comes to the gospel, that when I have a sense of what this means for the person I'm talking to, I'm have a sense of the lostness of this person and their eternal destiny apart from the Lord and the glory that God desires for them, like the more I understand that, the more acceptable that shame becomes, the more I am fully willing to just put that aside and say, this is worth it for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great example. You know, that situation pits your love for your daughter against your dignity, and which is more important. And, you know, love will make you be a fool because you're not ashamed of her, and that's who she is. So that's a great example. All right, well, how about we pray? Get a couple people to pray to wrap us up, and then we'll hang out. We've got pulled pork, and if you had a question I didn't get to, I'll be right here.
Yeah, Lord, sitting here listening to this teaching and just thinking about something that makes me feel shame sometimes to have the name badge of a Christian is just that there's a lot of Christians or people who say that they're Christian walking around really hurting people and saying falsely that being a Christian means being a good person or thinking that you're perfect when in reality it is actually because we know on a deep level that we are broken and that we can never be good enough to make it there. So I just pray, Lord, that you would really help us to really share our brokenness, our realness with people so that people don't think that we just think that we're a bunch of perfect people, but we understand that you paid for us to get into heaven.
God, thank you for this great reminder that perfect your love casts out fear. And I know that you're always waiting to hang out with me. And your love and faithful, even though I'm not. Thank you that you do pour that out as we make ourselves available.
God, I thank you that you created us. You sent your Son down. Thank you, Jesus, for coming. And thank you, Spirit, that you are in us, that you have given us ultimate truth. Pray that we can stand firm in that and be shameless for you, Lord.
God, thank you that you endured the cross and discounted the shame because you love us and for the joy that it gave you to rescue us. And thank you that you're not ashamed of us. And help us to represent you. Help us to be bold in that. Help us to be real in this world about who we are, about our faith in you, and to represent you well in those ways. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.